Hello, everybody. My name is Li Xinjin. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at University of Texas at El Paso. I typically introduce myself as environmental geochemist working on soil genesis. Actually, I have never been to a Soil Science Society of America before. So I'd like to thank Randy for the invitation so I can, you know, attend the meeting for the first time and also share with you some of the projects my student and I have worked on at UTEP. Specifically, I'll be talking about how flood irrigation in dryland agriculture has really led to accumulation of evaporated salts as well as pedogenic carbonate. And the implication of the pedogenic carbonate is that we think there's important carbon dioxide effluxes that can move the CO2 from the soil into the atmosphere. So 17% of the arable land in the United States are in dryland. However, agricultural practices are not really sustainable given that dryland is characterized by really low precipitation. So to grow any crops in the region, you need supply water. You need to irrigate irrigation. However, dryland is really low in precipitation, so we don't really have a lot of water resources available. Plus, agriculture have to compete with other uses for this precious water resources. On top of that, really high evaporation and transpiration driven by the high temperature really lead to salt accumulation. So that's why it's estimated more than 830 million hectares of arable land are really high in soil salinity and also high acidity. And this is a problem for soil sustainability. So I'm from El Paso, Texas. That's the western part of the Texas. We border with New Mexico and Mexico. Most of the agricultural soils in El Paso region are developed on sediments that are from the Rio Grande floodplains. So these soils are relatively young. They are on the order of several thousand years. And soil cultivation only become more extensive in the last 200 years. To illustrate that, what I'm showing you on the graph on the right are these blue lines. They are extensive irrigation network with drainage and canals. So a lot of water are going to be diverted. So by the way, the river is shown by these by this red curve. So significant amount of water is diverted from the Rio Grande and used for irrigation in El Paso region. And the method we use for irrigation is not very effective. We use flood irrigation, and some of you probably have seen that before. And it surprised me when I moved from Pennsylvania to Texas. So you can see the picture on the left is a pecan field where 1 to 1.5 meters of water is used for irrigation every year. During the growing season from April to October, every two weeks, the water will be flushing to the field, and you will see standing water for almost a week. And after that, with evaporation and transpiration, the soil moisture content in the soil start to decrease. The field start to dry out. So supported by an EPA grant, I work with my master's student, Kriti Cox, really looking at after 200 years of soil cultivation, how the soil quality will be, and what's the future of the region in terms of soil buildup. So we picked three major crops in the region, pecan, alfalfa, and cotton. At each site, we collect water samples, three types of them. Irrigation water, that's our input. We also install tensionless thermometers to collect soil waters at 15 centimeters, 30 centimeters, and 60 centimeters. We also collect the water from the drainage canals, so you can look at it as the water that exits the soils. For each water samples, we collect water quality parameters, including pH, alkalinity, electrical conductivity, concentrations of major elements, as well as strontium and carbon isotopes. The strontium isotopes can be used as a tracer for calcium for pedogenic carbonate. We also collect soil samples up to 80 centimeters deep at 10 centimeter interval. We characterize the soils for particle size analysis, so we'll know what kind of soil texture we work with. we also look at the water soluble fraction of the soil to evaluate how much salt has been accumulating using the saturation paste extract method. Using the chemistry of the leachate, we can calculate the sodium absorption ratio that gives us information about the acidity of the soils. At the same depth where we have the lysimeters for soil water collection, we also put in sensors to monitor the soil moisture, temperature, and the bulk soil electrical connectivity. The idea behind this design is that the lysimeters can give us water samples to look at during the first week of the irrigation when the field are pretty wet. After that, the lysimeters fail to provide any water samples, but we can still use the sensors to monitor the soil property conditions throughout the irrigation period. Just a picture to show that, you know, the sensors are connected to a data logger, and this is a cotton field. Let me start by showing you some of the water chemistry data we have collected. Arbitrarily, I put the irrigation water chemistry at zero because that's our input. And just so you know that most of our irrigation water is from Rio Grande, but in the last few years, it has become really dry in the region. Rio Grande dries up, the local farmers have no choice but drill more wells to use the groundwater for irrigation. And the drainage water is plotted at depth of 100 centimeters. Again, that's arbitrary. So you can see that, you know, in comparison to the irrigation water, the soil water and the drainage water are higher in electrical conductivity. That's not surprising given that the irrigation water, even though it's concentrated, but it's still undersaturated with respect to the evaporated salts. So during the initial irrigation, the irrigation water actually dissolves the salts that are present in the soils and leach that salt into the drainage water and the canals and the Rio Grande. The highest concentration or the electrical conductivity is observed at 60 centimeters, even though we don't have any water chemistry beyond the depth. The major, the dominant cations and ionites are sodium, chloride, sulfate, and calcium. So that's why when later on I'll show you, you know, the dominant evaporate phases are halite and gypsum. And these concentrations follow the trend of EC pretty well. Here I'm showing you the moisture content as a function of irrigation schedule. Again, that's exactly what we expect. The vertical lines are irrigation events, so about on average about every 2 weeks. And you see moisture content goes up and it decreases slowly when the water is lost by evaporation and transpiration. The bulk soil electrical conductivity pretty much follow the trend of the soil moisture, because when the soils are wetter, that will make the soils more conductive. Using the bulk soil electrical conductivity and making really bold assumptions on what the soil properties are, we can convert the bulk soil electrical conductivity into the pore water electrical conductivity. And the data is a little bit noisy, but the general trend is that when you start irrigate, you know, the water is irrigation water, that's our baseline. With more mineral dissolution, namely the dissolution of the evaporite phases, and with more evaporation and transpiration, the residual pore water becomes more and more concentrated. Eventually, the water becomes so supersaturated with respect to salts, the evaporite minerals will precipitate. So, you know, we see very close linkage between the Rio Grande and the soils. You can think about the Rio Grande is our source of irrigation water, and it will be diverted into the soils. But, you know, the salts, as well as fertilizers or pesticides, can be leached back to the Rio Grande through the shallow aquifers or the drainage canals. But overall, the salts are also a sink where the salts can accumulate, especially toward the later stage of the irrigation. One of the studies published about 4 or 5 years ago in Chemical Geology, they look at the salinity source of Rio Grande, and they sampled for 550 kilometers of the Rio Grande starting from distance zero on the x-axis. That's the headwater region of the Rio Grande. And they sample all the way to 500 kilometers downstream. And point 10 is where Las Cruces is, and point 11 is where El Paso is. So you can see that for sulfate concentration plotted on the y-axis, the sulfate concentration are pretty low to start, but there's a huge increase And they argue in this paper that the fertilizers used for the agriculture soils, which are dominant in the Las Cruces El Paso region, are contributing to this higher sulfate. And they prove that using the sulfur isotopes ratios. So let's move on to the soil properties. After 200 years of cultivation, we can see through this electrical conductivity data that the soils are pretty salty. On the vertical lines, I plotted the salt tolerance levels for different crops, for alfalfa, pecan, and cotton. So you can see for each crop, the soils we sampled have already exceeded the tolerance level of the crops. So I don't think we can, the soils may not be sustainable in the future. We did a simple calculation just using the amount of water for irrigation as well as the irrigation chemistry. We show that, you know, on average for the major species that are in the irrigation water, chloride, sulfate, and sodium, we on average load 1 metric tons of these species every acre per year. And that's pretty significant. These soils become really alkaline with pH around 8 to 8.2. And this becomes important later on when I talk about accumulation of pedogenic carbonate, because these are really alkaline soils. We also look at the sodium adsorption ratio. If the SAR is greater than 13, we know they are sodic soils, and that will have great implication on the behaviors of the clay. The clay in sodic soils will become dispersed. That means they will lower the permeability of the soil, make the water hard, difficult to penetrate. Therefore, the water will become pounded, lead to more accumulation of the salts. And you can see that, you know, some of the soils we work with are already over that limit. And the farmers have worked in these soils for several generations. They know how to work on soils like this. One way they can improve the silicity problem is by applying gypsum every 5 years. They will put 10 tons of gypsum per hectare, and that's pretty expensive. And my undergrad student, Alisa Lamar, did analysis of SAR before and after for the same soil and showed that, yes, of course, with addition of gypsum, the calcium can be dissolved from gypsum and kick out all the sodium in the soils and improve the silicity. And you can see from this graph, the SAR can be reduced by as much as 10. This gypsum addition can definitely improve the silicity problem, but it will not solve the salinity problem. So just to summarize the first half of my talk, I showed you that, you know, we just did a survey in our soils and show really high salinity and silicity problems. And we need to improve the method we use for irrigation, that's for sure. While we work on the evaporite minerals in the soils, we also look at the pedogenic carbonate. What I'm showing you here are the depth profile of the saturation index for calcite in different type of waters. Except for, you know, just a few points on the surface, which is the irrigation water. Most of the water we work with are oversaturated with respect to calcite. So that's why it's not surprising that we measured up to 15% of the calcite. But that's 15% of calcite in just several thousand years of sediments or soil. And the cultivation is only 200 years. So we become really motivated. My doctoral student, Anna Altis, so we are really trying to evaluate in the agriculture field through flood irrigation how much calcite has been produced and in comparison to the natural system, how faster we are. And through Ron's talk and some other talks from this conference, people have talked about, you know, pedogenic carbonate accumulation in natural systems. We want to understand where the calcium comes from, and how we can use these natural carbonate as a proxy for paleoclimate. And overall, the soil inorganic carbon accounts for 2 to 10 times more carbon than the soil organic carbon. So that's a really big pool. But if what we hypothesize is correct, that, you know, flood irrigation in agriculture field really accelerates the accumulation of pedogenic carbonate, maybe this is another example how humans have modified the greenhouse emission and therefore the global carbon cycles. So Anna's PhD dissertation is motivated by this research by this reaction, where if you load calcium and dissolved bicarbonate through irrigation, then you are going to form solid petrogenic carbonate as well as releasing one more of carbon dioxide. So her research questions are twofold. One, work on the solid phase to look at how much petrogenic carbon are in different soils, what the age of these petrogenic carbons, how fast they are accumulating, and again, how they compare to the natural rates. But the second set of questions, which is more challenging, is to look at the carbon dioxide in the system. The question we ask is, does calcite precipitation produce measurable soil carbon dioxide? And the challenge, of course, is how can you separate the abiotic carbon dioxide from the calcite precipitation from those biogenic carbon dioxide, which is from cell respiration, from decomposition of organic material, from root respiration, from microbial respiration. So our conceptual model is that on the top curve is the soil moisture content. It was really high at the beginning, the field was saturated, and with time the soil moisture will decrease. And the second panel shows the reactions involved. For most of the evaporated salts I talk about, you see an initial dissolution because the water is undersaturated and eventually at equilibrium. When you push the water out through evaporation and transpiration, the system becomes oversaturated, so salts start to accumulate. But for petrogenic carbonate or secondary calcite, the system is a lot simpler because the water is already at equilibrium or supersaturated with respect to calcite, so there's not even a dissolution here. So the only thing you see is the loss of water drive accumulation of petrogenic carbonate. And then the last panel showing you what the CO2 efflux should be as a function of this 2 weeks of irrigation. Initially, when the field was flooded, the gas bubbles have nowhere to go, so they have to be pushed out from the land to the atmosphere. So that's why you see a small peak at the beginning. And then later on, when the petrogenic carbonate start to accumulate, the CO2 have to be released as well. But the question is, where does this peak come from? Is it contribution from the calcite precipitation and coming from the soil respiration? And that's the difficult question. So again, our study area is still the Rio Grande Basin around El Paso. We focused on Pecan field only for this study because Pecan is pretty water demanding. And we have two sites picked in this Pecan orchard. I call them good Pecan and bad Pecan. And probably you see why just through this Google Earth map, because these Pecan trees are planted exactly the same time, but their size and productivity are quite different. The good Pecan trees are a lot bigger, they are greener, they are more productive than the bad Pecans. And through previous studies, we know exactly why some are good, some are not so good. This graph shows you the soil texture data for these two sites. On the left are depth profile, soil profile of the texture for the bad Pecan site, which I will use the blue color symbol for the later talks, for the later slides. And these are very clay and silty soils, especially around 100 to 150 centimeters. There's almost no sand particles at all. And on the right are the good or the sandy soil, where sand remain dominant for throughout the profile. So the good Pecans have sandy soil, so salt buildup is less serious. But the clayey soils definitely lower or reduce the productivity of the Pecans. In addition to soil and water samples I introduced before, we also put in a nest of gas samplers where we can collect soil gas samples from different depths and also from different seasons. And we can sample them and analyze for carbon dioxide concentrations as well as carbon isotopes. We also have four bases at each site where we collect CO2 efflux data. The CO2 efflux is referring to the CO2 movement from the soil into the atmosphere. So these four bases, when you move from the bare land toward the tree, it's going to be from B1 or G1 to B4 or G4. So let me show you some of the data we have collected last year, not 2011, it's 2015. So the x-axis are the irrigation for one irrigation event starting in June 9th. And then at the first week the water was standing in the field, so we cannot have access to take data. But after that, we take daily measurement on CO2 efflux at the same time every day. And what I'm showing you are the variation of the CO2 efflux at different sites. These green, blue, red, and purple colors are from the bad pecan sites. And they are much higher than those collected from the good pecan sites. That was very surprising because you would assume that the good pecans are more productive, so they have to be biologically more active, but that's not what we observed in terms of CO2 efflux. Even within the bad pecan site, looking at these four curves, moving from B1, which is more close to the bare land, to the tree from B1 to B4, you expect, you know, the CO2 efflux should be higher if they are dominant by the biogenic carbon dioxide, and that's not what we observed either. So just from these, you know, preliminary data, we suggest that the CO2 efflux we measured in this field are probably not dominant by cell respiration. Instead, they might be contributing more by the precipitation of calcite. Of course, we have to be cautious because we know there are differences in texture. So that might control how fast or slow the CO2 can be diffused out or advanced out into the soils. Another, in addition to the CO2 efflux, we also look at the carbon isotopes because carbon isotopes are more indicative of the source of the carbon. So we look at the carbon isotopes and the concentrations in the liquid phase, in the soil phase, as well as in the gas phase. So the first plot I'm showing you are the total carbon content in the soils. The data, the blue ones are for the bad soil, bad pecan, and the red curves are for good pecan. We haven't done the soil organic versus inorganic carbon yet, but you can assume that all the data from the top 50 centimeter are probably dominated by organic carbon, and these are more likely to be inorganic carbon. So we observed up to almost 2% of inorganic carbon. That's equivalent of 20% of calcite. And then the next plot I'm showing you are depth profiles of carbon isotopes of the organic matter in the soils. The delta 13C values range from 25 to negative 21. So that's typical C3 type of vegetation. That's in agreement with the pecan trees we have there. The next plot I'm showing you are the soil CO2 concentrations and isotopes. I plotted the carbon isotopes of the CO2 as a function of 1 over partial pressure of CO2. So you can see the data we collected fall into two clusters. The one on the right are likely to be mixing of the atmospheric CO2. Here it's likely to be mixing of the atmospheric CO2 because they are from shallow depths of the soils. And deeper soils show more likely to be the soil CO2. But if you compare the CO2, the carbon isotope of the CO2 and the source, which is the organic material, shown by these bars, the difference between the gas and the organic material are more than 4.4 per mL. So they are more than what can explain by molecular diffusion processes. So we argue there has to be some other processes that either add carbon dioxide of different sources or fraction the carbon more dramatically. And then here's the carbon systems of the liquid phase, namely the irrigation. The alkalinity is somewhere around 4 to 7 milliequivalent per liter. That's really high. And the carbon isotopes for the Rio Grande, which is the green dots, are somewhere around negative 6 to negative 10 per mL. So finally, it's the carbon isotopes of our pedogenic carbonate. And it doesn't matter where it's a good pecan or bad pecan site, the carbon isotopes is always around negative 4 per mL. So now we have two hypotheses. Either the pedogenic carbonate are naturally occurred, then that means they are controlled by isotope equilibrium with the soil CO2. Then depending on if you have C3 type of vegetation or C4 type of vegetation or atmospheric CO2, then the carbon isotopes of the pedogenic carbonate will be very different. And at the first look, the pedogenic carbonate seems to be in agreement with there might be C4 type of vegetation in the site, but that's not what has been recorded in the region. And another hypothesis is that the pedogenic carbon is more likely controlled by equilibrium with soil water DIC. So we did a really fractionation modeling, assuming the initial conditions of the irrigation water has a pH 7.5 to 8 with carbon isotope ratio of negative 6 per mL at 20 degrees C. We have the initial conditions where all the carbon, dissolved inorganic carbon, are in the solution. Then we push it to be oversaturated. Bicarbonate will slowly react with calcium, and half of that will be released as a carbon dioxide, and half of that will become calcium carbonate. And if you assume this is really fractionation, that means the fractionation factors between bicarbonate and calcite, bicarbonate and CO2, is only a function of temperature, then you can calculate what should be the final carbon isotopes for different reservoirs. So for calcite, it's around 1.4, negative 1.5 per mL. For CO2, it's likely to be negative 10.5 per mL. So if we put our model results into the real data, it seems to agree more or less with what we observed. So we argue that, you know, the pedogenic carbon we observe in the agriculture field are really dominantly controlled by loading of the calcium and bicarbonate from the irrigation, maybe with a tiny little bit contribution from the natural processes. If you put the CO2 and a member from the calcite precipitation, which is this orange dot, you can see that by adding this end member, you drive the point towards, negative 0.10 per mL. So that makes sense. So in summary, we observed up to 20% of pedogenic carbon in these agriculture fields, and that's pretty significant. And the carbon isotope system seems to suggest that most of this pedogenic carbon is induced by irrigation. Both the isotopes and concentrations, as well as CO2 efflux, seems to suggest that we observe a signature of carbon dioxide that's induced by calcite. And at last, I want to just emphasize that if our case study can be extrapolated into other regions, because dryland agriculture is everywhere and flood irrigation is used more than needed, then this CO2 efflux might become very important. And that's another example. Humans really change the greenhouse gas emission and the global carbon cycles. So with that, I'd like to thank my colleagues who have really helped me formulate the ideas, make the experimental designs, as well as data analysis. I also like to thank our hardworking undergrad and graduate students who make this project possible. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer questions if you have. Thank you. When you talk, I have to rephrase the question. I think the question is that have I looked at the water and to calculate how much CO2 has been produced from this calcite reaction?
If it's a reasonable assumption that the water, irrigation water in a couple meters of soil will produce that
It's more than the DIC we have in the water is more than enough to explain the CO2 efflux. Actually, the table I show you, the maximum loading of salt, that's the upper limit because some of the water drains through the soil and return to the Rio Grande. But we don't, that's more than enough. The short answer is more than enough. But, one thing we want to look at is by collaborating with some colleagues from biological science department at UTEP to use, the towers, ID efflux towers, where, we can look at, large scales, especially, above the agriculture field and see if they actually capture any signals of this reaction. Oh, I should point it out since you are here. This is a picture of our field first field trip collecting the soil samples. And he's not working, and this is me. And look at the girls. Look at the girls are working hard, and the guys are standing. Oh,
I just wanted to add a comment. You know, basically, part of the reason why you see more CO2 coming from the soil during 2011 till now is because farmers are applying sulfuric acid to the irrigation water. During the irrigation, because the so-called bad pecans are located on clay soil.
That's right.
That has a propensity to concentrate more salts. So what they do is they add sulfuric acid to utilize the calcite within the top 3 feet to make gypsum. You know, use native calcium to pump the solicity coming from the irrigation of groundwater. So that could explain partly why you have more CO2 in black and bad soil.
Right, but are you aware of that the sulfuric acid is used in this pecan field?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
But I would assume even that year we sampled.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure about this particular field, but in this region. I know.
Okay. But, you know, I talked to Steve Arvey about this already. I don't think it's done in this year. If they are applied, assume that the CO2 will be long diffused away, right? I don't think they will stay in the cells. That longer. But your point is right, is that they do put sulfuric acid to produce gypsum locally, right? And the sulfuric acid will react with the calcite to open the pores a little bit to improve the permeability at the same time. But of course, the farmers don't know how to work on these extremely, extremely harsh, you know, chemicals. So, but I want to mention that this is after all the guys dig all the pit. And we are just sampling. So that's why they are resting. They are helping a lot. All right.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
What factors contribute to the variability in texture? Field? Is it changes in microtopography?
Right. Actually, that's a good question. So so again, these sediments are from the floodplains. So depending on, you know, the magnitude of the flooding, depending on the macro topography, that's why the texture are different. We see pockets of, you know, sandy soils or a pocket of clay soils.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Craig.
Have you looked at adjacent fields that haven't been farmed, or are those available to see what the carbonate profile looks like?
You know, we definitely are looking for a control site, and but it's really difficult. It's very difficult. They either paved road or they are somebody's house. We were not able to locate a control, and we drove, you know, maybe 10 miles away, look at a control, but it tend to be very different sediment deposits. Yes, Randy.
Is there any irrigation management that's like micro sprinkler as opposed to flood irrigation along the Rio Grande? I mean, you have a lot of water sitting around evaporating. Is there any move toward micro irrigation,
and if so, could those be as a quasi-control? That if you look at micro-sprinklers versus flood irrigation, you'd be able to compare a less irrigated site. Right. That's exactly the design we have for cotton, alfalfa versus pecan, because pecan is the most water-demanding crops. So we thought, you know, if you work on the pecan side, you probably see more salt build up, and if you see pecan, maybe less build up. The few farms I work with, they all use flood irrigation because it's cheap. The water is not that expensive for the farmers, at least, you know, a few years ago. Maybe things will change when, you know, the Rio Grande really runs dry due to the climate change and the reduced in snowpack in Colorado region. By the way, that's Dr. Girish Gangjiganti. He's actually from Texas A&M AgriLife Center. And he worked more extensively in the field. So do you know if there's a push to go from the flood irrigation to more drip irrigation or?
See, I interact with growers regularly. The reason they say twofold, one is cost, like you were saying.
Right.
It needs pressurized system for sprinkler drip, so it involves a lot of cost. And the second thing is they're scared that if you apply less water, more water use efficient technology, it's not capable of reaching the soils. So that's their worry. And you know, unfortunately, we just have three crops grown in that region, and two of them are water, the salt sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
So alfalfa of the gum, we saw the threshold 2.6 and 2. So it's hard to convince the growers.
Yeah, so we have.
But I do know there's one grower near Van Hong. He uses drip irrigation, but this is grown water. He already has the pressurized system, overhead storage, so he has already been taking care of it.
Is there a difference in water quality between Van Horn and Vassar? So Van Horn water is higher quality water or lower quality?
Not necessarily. Grown water in general depends on the depth.
Must see up a sound.
Yeah. So 140 feet or maybe 200 feet of fresh water. Below that, blackish. So I think the land on is somewhat. Even in El Paso, ground water is like
El Paso has the largest inland desal plant. So we produce a lot of water too. Right, that's the question my proposal reviewer asked. Natural system, we know that, the accumulation of the pedogenic carbon is more limited by calcium, for example, right? So in irrigation system, we are not limited by calcium because there are really high calcium concentration in the irrigation water. So I think, it will precipitate calcite as long as you continue this irrigation practice. In terms of carbon sequestration, it really depends on how you look at it, because when you have the pathogenic carbonate accumulation, one more of carbon are being sequestered, but in the same time, you are releasing carbon dioxide into the air. And the question also comes to where the sources of carbon in that irrigation water, right? If the DIC you observe in the irrigation water are from dissolution of calcium somewhere else in Colorado, then you are really just reversing the process between dissolution and precipitation.
So the same for the calcium source, if you have
a
silicate-derived calcium, but if you're dissolving limestone in the calcium,
Exactly. But exactly. So, if you want to know the calcium source of in the irrigation water, then you have to do detailed studies on strontium isotope sieves that's from silicate dissolution versus carbonate dissolution.
We have entered kind of the discussion period of the symposium today. Are there any additional questions for Amy based on her presentation? Or anything else for Alicia? Amy, I had one question for you about the thin sections that you generated. Have you thought about analyzing those on an electron microprobe to be able to have elemental percentages and maybe calculate out some of the altered products or anything like that?
Yes, the preparation is difficult because of all the waste spaces. To get a good polish on that type of material is very difficult. It's something I could try. I have it tried, but I've kind of avoided it because of the difficulty of polishing the sample.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Okay, I have a question for you too. So I know some of the samples you collected are in the shells. So are there any rules or any double pocket? Because what we observed in the local area is that some of the trees actually have roots really deep because they know the pandemic carbon.
In my samples, I have to observe no roots, no fine roots. I did see in one of my SEMs samples of one of the voice pockets from Ohio, but not enough to really for me to think about any processes related to that. The vegetation is smart.
How deep is that compost?
I think this is
that would have been, those samples would have been maybe 30 centimeters deep.
And they were in the voice pocket.
How large is the excavation and wide?
Well, we just excavated blocks about this big from maybe 10 centimeters down. The exposures on SP1 and SP2 were only a couple of meters. So we couldn't go very deep in the middle.
Any other questions?
Longer trench.
All right, well, that looks like it concludes our symposium today.